Welcome to the Original Gangsters Members Only podcast. Scott Bernstein, along with my podcasting partner in crime, former Detroit mob figure Novi Toko. Thank you for joining us, Novi.
Good evening, Scott. How are you?
Good. Making my way back to the Midwest, slowly but surely. I'm in Utah right now and exploring some of the what they call national parks, just, you know, getting in touch with nature.
Oh, good for you.
Enjoy. Gaining an appreciation for some of the beauties of Mother Nature. And I've never been someone in my life that's ever really like gone hiking or camping, and made it a not a mandate, but I've as the last year and a half, as I've been doing a lot of traveling, kind of wanted to turn over a new leaf and see more of those kind of things. So me and my wife got a national park pass. So now whenever we head towards them, we stop and spend, in this case, a week, but a day or two. But it's beautiful. It really is.
Very good. Very good.
So we're going to talk about some stuff that's going on in the Boston area, some OG Boston mob stuff. One situation dealing with Whitey Bulger, who really probably needs no introduction, and then the other about a cold case murder from half century ago this week, and the FBI had a big press conference. The state police had a big press conference and announced that they're still actively pursuing leads in this unsolved murder, and we're going to go over some of the details of that. But let's start with Whitey Bulger, and he's been dead for 8 years, and the story never seems to be put to bed. There's always, we're finding out new things, and this was a real, Novi never met him. But,
no, I get that. I met some people involved with him, but not him.
And they were, Whitey and his guys were in town in Detroit in the late 70s fixing races at Hazel Park right after your uncle sold the place. So there's some crossover with Detroit with some of those Winter Hill guys. But this guy was so much, I always want to emphasize what I'm talking about him, that as bad of a guy as you think he was worse. He wasn't just a gangster who made his life in the rackets. He was a predator. And sometimes the movies or the television shows make him kind of asexual, when in reality, he might not have been a classic womanizer in the sense of sleeping with a lot of women his age. But he was somebody that was preying on little boys and little girls in Southie for decades.
Oh, I didn't know that. That is completely news to me.
Right. Well, so even Novi doesn't really. So I always want to let people know that that's a part of his legacy that really hasn't been properly fleshed out because of all the other depravity in his reputation.
Yeah, and I never heard that even from people from that part of the country. Never said that. I don't know how well known it was, but
I think it was known within those communities of Southie and Somerville, but it wasn't a widely known thing. It started to get reported in some of the books and magazine articles that were written while he was on the run for 16 years. But he had a couple girlfriends, steady girlfriends. So it wasn't like he was somebody that was parading around single, but those were kind of quasi beards. He wasn't known as a guy that liked to chase skirts. He was, again, he had a predilection for younger people. And I don't want to put moral and ethical judgments really in any of this. Everybody's, a human being, but there are criminals, there are crime lords, and then there are what he was.
Okay, I'm going to agree with you on that. That's something that's a no-no. You don't fool around like that.
Oh, God, it's really and they actually, I'll give Marty Scorsese credit for he alludes to it without saying it in Departed. The first, like, first couple minutes that you meet the character that Jack Nicholson's playing, which was a character that was inspired by Bulger, you see that he goes to a young girl who's probably 13, 12, 13, 14, and he gives her money and he asks if she had her period. And I think that's a implying that he had been sleeping with her and wants to make sure she's not pregnant.
I saw the movie once and I don't remember that scene. So
it was subtle. Okay. So Whitey, it's come out now, just in the last couple weeks, that Whitey was working on a autobiography when he was on the run. He was writing it himself. And when they caught him in Santa Monica, California in spring of 2011, they uncovered hundreds, and we're just finding this out now, you know, 25 years after, or sorry, 15 years after they found it, 8 years after he died, that there were hundreds of pages of his musings on his life. And he was, it appears, very honest in a lot of this manuscript. Obviously, I don't think it will ever see the light of day, but some of the revelations in the manuscript are being used by some of the dirty FBI agents that were operating him that are trying to get cases reversed, and they're using some of Bulger's admissions as potentially ways to clear them of wrongdoing. So in these court filings that were filed at the beginning of the spring, we learned about this manuscript, and I want to go over some of the passages that I think are telling. One thing that I found interesting, and I'll give him credit for this. He had a very, very honest assessment of why he did what he did at the beginning of the manuscript. He says, in all honesty, I became a criminal, a thief, a drug dealer, because it was easier than working an honest living. So, I mean, that right off the bat, I'll give him credit that was that's an honest assessment. Novi, any thoughts?
No, that sounds like a very honest assessment, because that's why you go into that life. You can go into the life as a criminal and you make enough money to be comfortable, and it doesn't take up your whole day. So you got a lot of time for yourself and take care of things you like to do.
And Whitey is somebody that I think, whatever you think about him, and I have my opinions as I've shared, if you've studied him and you've talked to people that knew him and you talked to law enforcement that worked him, he was brilliant. He had a very high IQ. So everything for good and bad was thought out. He wasn't impulsive in the way other mob bosses or crime lords that have reputations for hair trigger tempers. That wasn't Whitey. All of his violence, and there was a lot of it, was very contemplated. But I will give him credit. When I read that, I tell Novi this all the time. Novi is such a peach. I mean, Novi, in the world that I exist in, where I talk to wise guys and ex-wise guys all the time, Novi, you truly are an outlier. You are a good man, and you're a straight shooter. You're not a bullshitter. And there's so many people out there that are intellectually dishonest. So
Well, that's why I admitted to you. That statement by Whitey Bulger, at least that's an intellectually honest statement. Right. I mean, we don't go into this life worrying about whether they're going to make it through the day unless you've got reasons for it. And the reasons are it's easier to make a living that way, and you got plenty of time to enjoy life.
And I'm talking just in general. I think Novi is not the he's lived the he's lived the movie script, and he was right in the middle of all of this. But not everybody in that world has a heart. And I think it probably comes from your, your bloodline, your grandfather, although he was the very, very powerful man in the world of La Cosa Nostra, was known as a man with a huge heart. And your father as well. I don't know, I'm comparing you to Whitey Bulger, so I don't know if there's a high bar. but in general, I'll just say that I interact with people like Whitey Bulger all the time. Whitey out of the gate being able to say that, I'll give him credit for it. And then some of these other comments are pretty unflinchingly raw when you're looking at the circumstances. So there's two more things I want to touch on in terms of hit the passages. Okay, so one, I think it demonstrates his how, again, what I said a couple minutes ago about him being very deliberate in how he went about doing his evil. And he talks about how he was on the run, and I think it was the late 90s, early 2000s, and one of his lieutenants pops up on 60 Minutes. And he's talking about what was going through his mind at that point. And he talks about a desire, and this is where I say that he was not impulsive, that he controlled his impulses, and that his desire was to go back to Boston with a machine gun and go find this guy and kill everybody that he believes did him wrong. So he's talking about watching his lieutenant give him up on 60 Minutes. He says, naturally, I'm very angry. If it was up to me and there weren't the consequences I knew that would come after, I would prefer to just go back to Southie and settle this on my own with my gun. However, I'm aware of what's going on today in surveillance. There are many cameras that record everyone and everything. A lot has changed since my years in the street. They have eyes in the sky looking everywhere. License plate numbers, images of pedestrians, images of criminals. My good sense indicates that a kamikaze attack by me in my old hometown would not be wise, since I would be limited to only one target. So it's like you get the insight into this sick mind that wants to go and kill everybody, but doesn't see that it would be worth it because he'd only be able to kill one guy before he got caught.
That's some reasoning, isn't it?
Right.
So I
found that fascinating, just to get a lens into his mind, and that you could see that his first inclination was that he wanted to go scorched earth. He wanted to go back and kill everyone that had done him wrong, like he had done in his past. But for the sake of him and, I guess, his freedom, and for, I guess, in terms of gangland bang for your buck, he decided against it. But that's what he was thinking when he was watching one of his guys on 60 Minutes. And then finally, and I think this shows how precarious his situation was, and even while he was on the street. So I don't know if Novi knows this or not, but when he was on the street, the Boston Globe put out a story, a front page story, that he was a cooperator. And this was 7 years before his reign came to an end. And it didn't make a dent because it was so, at the time, it was so outlandish. I mean, it seemed so outlandish. The front page of the biggest newspaper in that city, when he was at the peak of his power, and there's an article that says Whitey Bulger is a CI. And it didn't stick to him. Everybody thought it was, you know, his enemies on the street feeding bad info to the Boston Globe. But it was true. And Whitey knew who had tipped off the Globe. And it was not the famous agent that was corrupted, John Connolly, who had grown up with Bulger, but it was Connolly's partner, John Morris. So Bulger called the FBI office the day that article came out. And he called and he got John Morris on the phone, telling John Morris's secretary that he was the former mayor of Boston, Kevin White, who was an Irish guy, who was the mayor in the 70s. So Bulger lies to the secretary, says, "This is Kevin White. I need to talk to John Morris." Gets Morris on the phone and says, "I'm going to blow your brains out." So he's calling. So White Bulger, while he's the mob boss of Boston, the day that this article comes out in the Boston Globe in 1988, summer of 88, he calls one of the FBI agents that was handling him, who he believed and turned out to be true, had tipped off the Globe, says, "I'm going to blow your brains out. Just remember, if I go down, you go down." And then he hung up the phone. It's pretty ballsy.
Well, ballsy, I'll say. But you know what? He had those two FBI agents in his back pocket. They were claiming he was their CI, and he knew he was nobody's CI. He was using them, and he just twisted that knife a little bit.
Well, he used, and we never really had this in Detroit. At least in modern times, where you had an Irish group that could be considered on the same level as an Italian group. And in this case, you had the only real information Bulger was giving to the FBI in his 20, or he was probably 30 years, because he was informing back in the 60s, but his 20 years of informing when he was a boss. The only credible information he was giving them was information to take down the Italians.
Of course.
Which provided him more territory to grab up.
Yeah, of course. And Boston being so overwhelmingly Irish in South End, it would figure that the streets would be controlled by the Irish. And in that case, a smart Italian, which old man Patriarca was, he would have made a treaty with Bulger, you know, but Bulger had a few Italians going for him too. He had a few Italians that were informing on the Italian outfit to him,
right? And he had a group of Italians that were. And this is, I love this where things aren't so black and white. Sometimes, you know, a lot of times when people are putting organizational charts together, they have these very kind of like strict definitions of who should be with, but. The Winter Hill Gang was the Irish mob, but there were Italians that were not made members of La Cosa Nostra, but were quote unquote made, or for all intents and purposes, made guys in the true. Irish mob.
Yes, I you're absolutely true. I found that out both times where I had contacts with Irish guys from New England, also. From an Italian guy from New England who was half Irish, half Italian, and he had a brother that was very close to Whitey Bulger, and you could tell the way he talked that there was there was loyalty was there wasn't to anybody's nationality. It was to who's making the most money for them.
Right. And, you know, just in the Detroit situation with Winter Hill, well, there's 2 points I want to make. First, and they dovetail, because when those guys came in the 70s, those Winter Hill guys, they were getting the intro to your grandfather's people by Old Man Patriarca and his people. They were essentially vouching for the Irish to come into Detroit, fix the races, and everybody's getting a piece. The Italians in Detroit, the Italians in New England, and the people that are running point on it are the Irish. But who's running? But within the Irish, the guy that was actually running point, who was a member of the Irish mob, but he was Italian, was Tony Chula. So Tony Chula, who was representing the Irish mob from Boston, but was Italian, was in Detroit as the, you know, as the quarterback of all those fixes.
And some of that fix, I know who they used here in Detroit to do that. And all of my adult life. Go ahead.
They were at DRC too. They weren't just at Hazel Park.
Yes, they were doing it at racetracks, both racetracks. You're right.
They were like here for on and off for like, I think, I'm saying here. I'm not there now, but we're, you know, where I usually am in Detroit and where Novi is right now. They were here for like on and off for like 2 years. They were doing this. This wasn't like
you got to remember those 2 years. Those are during the meets, and during the meets at Hazel Park, they were what 3 or 4 months long. I don't remember how many days. And DRC was the same amount of time. The rest were trotters. I don't think they fooled with the trotters so much, that but they were doing it with the flats, the runners. And I know that some of the guys that were doing the work for them were out of the Italian clique, you know, and that knew how to do that work.
So last point I want to make, and this I think plays into what you were saying about Old Man Patriarca. Patriarca was on the descent, not in terms of power, but in terms of health.
Correct.
That Whitey was on the ascent. So if Old Man Patriarca had been alive, I'm guessing Whitey doesn't achieve everything he achieved. Because Raymond was, right when Whitey was getting all this power, Raymond was fighting heart problems and eventually died in 84. But, you know, Whitey was getting the power in the 70s, and then by the 80s was really leveraging it. And that was when Raymond Sr. was going out of the picture and Raymond Jr. was coming into the picture, and they were contrasts in at least respect. Jr. didn't have any of the respect that Sr. had, and then that allowed Whitey to do a lot of stuff I don't think he would have been able to do on the dad's watch.
Well, I'm going to agree with you on the respect angle. The father commanded much more respect nationally than the son ever did at any point with anybody.
That was probably a misstep. Not probably. It was a misstep on Raymond Sr. Sometimes you're blinded by your love for your son and wanting the best for your son. And probably if Raymond Sr. Didn't have the agenda of wanting to continue his dynasty or his legacy, he probably would have done what some other mob bosses have done, where they look at their sons and they're like, maybe this isn't the life for you. Because Junior really was not equipped to be a mobster, let alone a mob boss.
That's what I understand. I didn't know Junior, but I know a few guys that knew him pretty well, and they say the same thing. You know, and I saw that happen in Detroit too. There was some children that shouldn't have been involved, you know.
And then for this, you know, it goes a lot deeper than, you know, just the patriarchs, because the domino effect of that and we've seen this in other, I mean, we're so lucky in Detroit because we've never really had any of open internal warfare. But you saw it in Philadelphia when Angelo Bruno was killed and all hell breaks loose for 20 years. And then when old man Patriarca dies, it's a decade of war because everybody didn't want to support Junior. And Junior couldn't get the support of Boston and those guys. And then you had a mob boss that came into power that was half Irish and half Italian, and Cadillac Frank. And he, for his reign, was able to have feet in both camps. And that served him well. You know, he had the Irish at Bulger and his guys. They basically worked to get the group before that out of the picture so they could put Salemi in, because they knew that he'd be loyal to them because he was half Irish.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, no, so I understand. And I'll tell you the truth. Some of the old timers in Detroit, that's exactly what they wanted to avoid. No mixed blood.
Okay, so let's go. We'll finish up with, I guess you could say this is, every city has their own Jimmy Hoffa, you know, a murder mystery that just will never die no matter how old it gets. There's still going to be law enforcement trying to crack the case. There's still going to be regular civilians that talk about it and gossip about it. There's going to be mobsters that gossip about it. So if you're not from New England, you probably don't know about it. But within New England, it's very infamous. And I've learned about it recently because I report on New England. I probably learned it about 10 years ago. I had some law enforcement talking to me about it. Okay, so it happened in April of 1976, so it's 50 years. That's why there was a press conference last week. And the murder was of a Boston mob associate, but the crime itself, the homicide, and the body were committed and then found in Maine. So it involves two separate sets of law enforcement, the feds in Massachusetts, as well as the state in Massachusetts, and then the state and feds in Maine. And we've said this before, that Detroit hasn't really had anything, you know, state police, local police. By the time the 60s were over with, it was all feds that were working in Detroit. Yeah, well, you guys didn't have to worry. In the 80s, you weren't worrying about state police, were you?
No, we weren't, because the state laws were such that it was hard for them to corral us. And the feds, they were coming down hard on us.
It's interesting, as I, you know, I study multiple areas, but like Chicago, Detroit, they never had to worry about state police. They were worried about the feds. But in areas like New England, the state, in all the different New England states, the state police departments are very active, even now, in organized crime investigations. So this was a press conference by the Maine State Police, I guess in coordination with the Boston FBI, but the Maine State Police were the ones that held the press conference. The name of the associates was Jim Cassidy. He was a banker, mild-mannered guy, not someone that you would ever take for a mobster or a mob associate. Irish guy, was the vice president of a bank in Brookline, Massachusetts, which I've been to often in my life because I got family there. Started out as an Irish neighborhood. It's where the Kennedys lived, and then became a Jewish neighborhood. And it's right on the border of Boston, and it's a really nice suburb. And this guy was the vice president of the main bank in Brooklyn. He also owned a rare stamp collection business. According to investigators, they believed that he was laundering Boston Mafia money through the bank and the stamp collection business. So a bus comes down on April 4th of 1976, and Cassidy is indicted that morning for embezzling $1 million of 1976 money. Okay. That would be like 10 million or 20 million today, of mob money through Brookline Bank and Trust. That's the name of the bank. He's indicted on April 4th. He disappears before anybody can arrest him. He at this point was not kidnapped. He was on the run. And I think that that time on the run lasted 24 to 48 hours before the mob caught him, before the cops caught him. Allegedly. I mean, that's what the investigation believes. So Cassidy, who was doing this stuff with Jerry, allegedly, with Jerry Angiulo's guys. Jerry Angiulo was the underboss of the entire organization under Old Man Patriarca in Providence, but Jerry Angiulo was in Boston and he controlled the whole city for a long time. I mean, from the 50s into the 80s. And he had a lot of brothers. He had, I think he had four or five brothers. Anything that was going on in the North End in Boston in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s was going through Jerry Angiulo and his brothers. And one of his brothers had a crew of guys that had ins with Cassidy. So he disappears April 4th. Or sorry, he disappears on the morning of April 4th. His wife said he went to work at the bank. She didn't know anything about the indictment, but he never actually went to the bank that morning. He kissed his wife goodbye, said he was going to the bank. In reality, he took off and he goes to Maine. And there are two sightings of him in Maine on April 4th and 5th. So the day he disappeared and then the day after. One of the sightings is in Portland, Maine, and the other sighting is in Bangor, Maine. The sighting in Portland was of a meeting that Cassidy took at the Portland airport, where an unidentified individual, I'm guessing the authorities know who this guy is, but they don't mention it in the press release or any of the filings on it. There was a meeting on April 5th, the day after he disappeared. There's a meeting at the Portland, Maine airport, where there's an exchange made, an envelope exchange between Cassidy and this unidentified individual. And they believe that there was some type of money and some of the stamps possibly that had some value transferred into the possession of this unidentified individual. Then there was another sighting of him in Bangor. And then the authorities believe that he was killed either April 5th or 6th. So he was either killed the same day he had this meeting in Portland or the day after. His body's found on April 8th. So 4 days after he's last seen by his wife, and 2 or 3 days after he's last seen at these meetings, he's found dead, beaten to death, strangled, and set on fire in a Chrysler pickup truck in the middle of a farm field in Hancock County off of Route 9 in Maine, like a very like rural part of Maine, like out in the boonies. Never been able to arrest anybody. And the authorities said last week that the case remains open. There is a $50,000 reward for information leading to any arrests, and that they're still working leads in this case. another thing that is a compelling fact here, the day that within hours of the media announcing that he had been found dead. So they announced it on April 9th. Within a couple hours of the news hitting the media, the person that had made the exchange with Cassidy at the Portland airport cashes a $10,000 check at his bank in Framingham, which was probably about 30 minutes from downtown Boston. So $10,000 in 1976 money is cashed out on a check that I guess Cassidy had made from his, not his personal account, but from his stamp business account. An hour or two after the media announces that he's dead, this guy that had gotten the package from Cassidy cashes a check. And then the other piece of important evidence is investigators know that a pair of men from Boston rented a car out of Bangor, Maine on April 5th and had it to April 8th. So it appears that he left Boston, arrived in Maine on the 4th, the same day the indictment comes down, and the hit team that was looking for him, that was coming from Boston, arrived the next day. They rent a car, assume that these guys were the ones that killed him, give the car back on April 8th, and then return back to Boston. Does it look, I mean, that's it.
It sounds to me like the guy he met got the check and gave this banker some running money. Oh, and that check was to cover the running money.
I kind of sense that the guy that got the money, who very well might have also provided money to Cassidy to run.
Yeah, and the security for that check would have been some stamps in the envelope that they knew was worth something. And he gives him a check, says, I need some running money, gets $10,000. That's probably the guy who tipped off the team. But it's all supposition.
No, that's what I was about to say that. I'm thinking that the guy that met him at the Portland airport and did that exchange, which was probably on April 5th, probably the morning of April 5th. He gets there April 4th, sets this meeting up early. I'm speculating. Early to mid-afternoon April 5th. And then the guy that gets the package tips off the guys in Boston who come up to Maine that day and rent a car.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. But it's all speculation. Right. Nobody knows.
But we know
and
the
it
car
sounds to me like the police have just got speculation too.
Right, but what does it say? I mean, Hoffa, it's so infamous. It's so larger than life. And there's so much embarrassment on the part of the FBI. I can understand taking away my own personal feelings and the fact that it's crazy that the Hoffa case is still open. But I can understand it to a degree because of the infamy. Even if it's local infamy with this Cassidy thing, one of my takeaways, and this is pure speculation, is that they think that some of the guys that are running the Boston mob right now, and the Boston mob is being run by some old timers, guys that are in their 80s, I suspect that they think that Bobby Carrozza, Spooky Spagnuolo, Biagio Di Giacomo. I'm sorry, they call him Benny, Benny the Greaser Di Giacomo, or Vinny the Animal Ferrara. So that's Ferrara, Carrozza, Di Giacomo. And Spooky. I would, and they, and at that point in time, they were hitters.
Yeah, they were young go-getters. Yeah. 50 years ago, it would have been in their 30s.
Yeah. And Spucky, specifically, Spucky and Vinny were suspects and hits back in the 70s. There's no other takeaway that I can really make other than they think that one of those people that are in power now had something to do with this back then, and they hope that somebody from, you know, the public that's been keeping their mouth shut for 50 years will come out and say something. It doesn't seem like there'd be any other reason to keep this case open.
Well, that's true. Unlike the Jimmy Hoffa case, that's such a black eye for the FBI. But all the people involved are dead. But
Right. There's nobody right now, and I'll put my firstborn on the line in terms of a bet. There's nobody left to arrest in the Jimmy Hoffa case. Nobody
absolutely
that was there.
I absolutely agree with you.
There's nobody involved in the conspiracy to murder Jimmy Hoffa at any level of that conspiracy that is still alive right now.
Correct.
So the Hoffa case, there's more than meets the eye, I think, in terms of why they want it open, because of, like you just said, I think it's a personal thing. It's a wanting, you know, for the sake of Uncle Sam's pride and never stopping until you finish a job. They want to be able to say they put it to bed officially.
Yeah.
But there's nobody to arrest. In this case, I believe that they think there are people to arrest.
Yeah, that is probably true. To keep a local murder that really didn't make national news like Jimmy Hoffa, it's because they think somebody is alive, or more than one person is alive, that committed that crime.
And I'll say that with Vinny Ferrara, who, you know, a lot of times in life, things that seem like surefire fate don't turn out in that direction. And I think Vinny Ferrara is a perfect example. Vinny was the rising star of all rising stars in the Boston mob in the 70s and 80s. Everybody thought for certain that he was going to be boss one day. And just because of the way the cookie crumbles, and he had to go away to prison for a nice little chunk, that didn't happen. He's now 80 years old and is not a boss, but he's still a powerful member of that family. From what I'm told and from what law enforcement has told us, he runs the rackets out in Norfolk County, which is, you know, for anybody from Detroit, it's like Oakland County. It's like where the nice swanky suburbs. And he's been under fire, not literally, figuratively, by the state police, not the FBI. So that's where I'm thinking there might be some state police coordination between the state police in Massachusetts and the state police in Maine, because we know for sure, these are two things we know for sure. We know for sure that the driving force behind this current open cold case investigation that's looking and tracking down leads in 2026 for that 76 murder is Maine State Police. We know for sure that Vinny Ferrara has been under investigation by Massachusetts State Police for a while now, and that they have confiscated, and that the state police in Massachusetts have on a number of occasions taken money out of Vinny's personal and business accounts, claiming that they're monies that were accumulated via illegal activity. I think there's been over $250,000 that's been taken from Vinny in the last 5-6 years, and he's been fighting to get it back. And every time that he gets in front of a judge to argue to get it back, the state police show the judge that in their opinion, it's illegal money. The judge agrees with them and he doesn't get the money back. But there has been an active state investigation on Vinny Ferrara in Massachusetts. There's an active investigation in this case with Cassidy in Maine. Vinny was the Angiulo's, you know, top enforcer at that point. So I guess that's some of the math that I'm doing. I don't think this will turn into anything. As confident as I am putting my firstborn on the line for nobody from the Hoffa case being alive to arrest, is as confident as I am that they're not going to make a case against any of these guys in Boston for this thing in Maine. I don't see it.
And I agree with you, because it sounds to me like they're keeping it open and grasping at straws. And, and they're having trouble. They have to fight them to keep $250,000 they grabbed from them. And that's the state did that to them?
Yeah, that's the kind of dots that I'm connecting. Doesn't mean anything other than I'm doing this in my head.
That's another reason why, see, some of these states have laws that the state police can be more active against a national organization than states like Michigan or Illinois.
Well, I commend anybody that is relentless in pursuing justice and accountability decades later. And in this case, you know, I'll give investigators the benefit of the doubt and say there probably is likely people that were involved in this in some capacity that are probably still alive. But there's a big bridge between knowing something or suspecting something and then being able to bring a case. I mean, these were guys that were heavily hunted targets. If there was any way they could bring these guys, meaning Carrozza, Benny DiGiacomo, Spucky, Vinny the Animal, and if there was any way they could have brought these guys in on a hit like that, they would have done it already.
Oh, absolutely. That's true.
And, you know, Vinny did get convicted of a hit, but he got that murder overturned on appeal, and that's why he's out and about and free. But when he went away in the 90s, it looked like he was never getting out, and that was related to the Jimmy Lamoli murder from 85. And Jimmy Lamoli was one of Vinny's drivers and message relayers, and Jimmy Lamoli was a brazen thief, ripping off a lot of made guys. And when you're ripping off made guys, and even when you're a made guy ripping off made guys, you're putting your life in line.
Yeah, you're putting your life in their hands.
But if you're a non-made guy ripping off powerful made guys, you're writing yourself living on borrowed time. yeah. So, but Vinny was able to get that case overturned because one of the witnesses in the case, there was some chicanery behind the scenes on his testimony. So Vinny got that part of his conviction overturned. And he's been free now for about 20 years, I think. I think he got out in 06 or 07. But, just wanted to go over that. I thought it was interesting. Novi, thank you for joining me and going over some Boston mob history.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
We'll be back next week, and we'll be giving you more true crime history and analysis. When I get back, one of the things that we're going to do, me and Novi, we talked about this last year, and then I left town for half the year. We're going to go over some, if Novi's okay with it, we're going to go over some pictures. And I know there's been some audience members that want us to kind of go over some old pictures and show some, maybe some photos of people that they haven't seen before. And I got some that nobody has seen before. No, I think nobody has some that nobody has seen before. So that's something I think will be cool. Well, when I get back and Novi are together. And then as I keep on saying, I'm going to will this into existence. We're going to have a whole team of OG members only personalities by the end of this year. And we're going to be doing a lot of like crossovers and people being able to chime in with different cities. We're going to have Novi in Detroit. We're going to have somebody in Chicago, somebody out in on the east, a couple people out on the East Coast. So I'm excited for that. I'm sorry it's taking me a little longer to put it together than I thought, but we're trending back in that direction. So, Novi, enjoy the rest of the weekend, and I will see you soon. We'll jump on a podcast soon next week and give the audience some more to devour.
Okay, Scott, thank you for having me. You have a good evening.
All right, so for Benny behind the glass, thank you so much. To all the viewers out there, thank you so much for supporting us. We love bringing you the most elite and exclusive true crime news and analysis. For Novi Toko, for Benny Augusta, I'm Scott Bernstein. We will see you next time.